The Survival Guide to Life, a podcast about how to win in life every second, physically, mentally, spiritually, financially, consistently. Get this recording.
When I was watching one of your videos, Doctor, I heard you saying or iterating, you know, you wanted to be the president, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's sort of like you went down different paths and you sort of like learned what you didn't want to do. And then finally you came into what you did want to do. What was that like, and like what was your mindset, and like what were you searching for? Like, because I'm sure there's so many people who have this, you know, like question, like, you know, what do I want to do? And like everyone, you know, there's things we like, but we necessarily don't really know what we want to do.
No, that's a great question, Omar. I mean, I think all of us, it's just as important to find out what we don't like doing as it is what we do like doing. And so I've been blessed throughout my life to have opportunities to serve in different positions. And the story you're referring to was I worked for a United States congressman on Capitol Hill, and that was in college. Whereas in high school, one of the jobs I had, which I had a number of jobs, I went anywhere from being a gardener, I worked for a river raft company, I worked as a paralegal, but I also worked as an attendant at a health club where I cleaned the toilets every night. And if anyone were ever to ask me, which would you prefer, working on Capitol Hill or cleaning toilets again, I would much rather clean toilets than ever work on Capitol Hill. That's because a lot of the people I worked with were just nasty, horrible people. The congressman was actually a good person, but his staff was just a bunch of real jerks. And one of the things I've really kind of come to understand in life is too short to work with jerks, and so I've just kind of eliminated jerks from my life. So if I see jerks around me, we're doing something wrong. So I try to surround myself with good people. So I've done lots of different things. Education was not what I had intended to do. For like you had said, I wanted to be president of the United States. And after working on Capitol Hill and speaking around the country and watching what politicians do, I've learned that I might be really good for running for president, but I don't know if I'd be very good at being the president. Those are two very different skill sets. Running for president is giving lots of speeches, and that's the kind of thing I love to do. But being the president is attending lots of meetings, and I wouldn't want to deal with that. There's nothing. I suffer from a condition called meeting narcolepsy. I need a medical alert bracelet that just says, when I'm falling asleep during a meeting, just get him out of the meeting. We'll be all right. I'm a person that likes to take action. I don't like to be around people that just talk all the time.
No, doctor, is something like speaking or public speaking or just, you know, presenting been something that you have like been fond of from like a young age?
Yeah, I don't think I've ever met a microphone I didn't like. Even from a very young age, I was a performer. My mom was an actress, and I think she says that she put me in my first play. She was in a play when I was, I think, 4 years old. 4 years old, I was a fairy in A Midsummer Night's Dream in a play that she was in. So I've always loved being on the stage. I love getting people to laugh. And being a speaker as well as a writer. When I was a journalist, one of my editors once told me, he's like, Danny, you're a really funny writer, but if you truly want to be a great writer, you need to make people laugh, you need to make people cry, and you need to make people think. And as a speaker, as I've evolved, I've realized, okay, the most effective presentations can have elements of all three of those things in them. And it's very gratifying to me, and it's I've had more than one person who has told me not to pursue other things. They're like, I think you're doing the right thing, Danny. I think you're really making a difference. And so I think so, too.
I agree as well.
Thank you.
So with you know, just going on and just, like, the more you've developed with speaking, like Malcolm Gladwell in his book, I think it was The Outliers, he said, you know, like, it takes 50,000 hours to be an expert in something, right? So
only 10,000 hours.
Oh, 10,000. Okay.
Yeah,
so So you could say you're an expert in speaking. So what would you say is, you know, like, the criteria in, like, delivering a good speech?
Well, we'll address both of those points. First of all, I think the two terms that irritate me beyond no end right now are expert and thought leader.
Oh,
those things drive me nuts. Especially, I'll be on stage and somebody says, "Oh, I'm an expert in Instagram." I'm like, Instagram's been around for what, 10 years? Thought leader, you know, I'm a thought leader. What does that mean? I'm a thought leader. I guess I'm just a thought follower because I have no idea what a thought leader is. That really irritates me. But getting back to the second part of your question, which is what does it take to be a good speaker? I think I watch speakers all the time. I watch anywhere from televangelists to politicians to comedians. I'll watch long speeches. I'll watch TED Talks, which are only about 18 minutes. I'll watch commencement addresses, which are 10 to 15 minutes. I watch acceptance speeches at award shows to see if a person can convey a meaningful message in 45 seconds. I watch people in front of big crowds, in front of small crowds, in rural environments, in city environments. And I think one of the speeches that resonated with me was by Brené Brown. She's like a hot stuff right now, but she says something really meaningful in one of her speeches where she's really talking about being authentic. And you'll see a lot of these organizations and coaches that are teaching you how to be a great speaker. And I don't think that people are looking for polish. I think people are looking for authenticity. And so when people ask me, what's your best tip as a speaking coach? Because I work, you know, I've worked with probably just a couple of hundred people this month on developing their signature talks and becoming better speakers to grow their businesses. And the best tip I always give to those people is don't tell people about your successes. You know, tell them about your failures, because everybody in your audience might not have succeeded yet, but they've all failed. And the moment you show the vulnerability that you failed, they're going to start paying attention to you because they're going to believe that you have something to share with them. I mean, in the first 5 minutes of any good speech, I think you need to show the audience three things. I think you need to show the people that you're extraordinary, but you're also ordinary, and then you have to show people your why. And so when I'm working with, I was working with a whole bunch of financial planners yesterday on how to grow their financial planning businesses through speaking. And so we were developing their talks, and one of the things that they couldn't get through their heads is they were using all these fancy terms that financial planners understand, but normal people don't understand. And I said, okay, let's stop. Here's what you got to do. You got to say that your superpower is that you're a translator and that you speak financialese. So when a person gives this obscure term, here's what they really mean. And that's when they finally clicked with the guys. I'm like, you know, simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I learned this as a journalist is, you know, a lot of people like to impress you with their extensive vernacular. You know, how about we just put it in plain English so people understand, oh, the words that you use, how can we make ourselves understood to the largest number of people? And so I think that's what it takes to make a great speech. The other thing I work with people on is, there's lots of research on this, and I'm a huge fan of Malcolm Gladwell. I'll devour anything he's ever written. But in a really good speech, you know, there's been lots of researchers that have talked about the primacy and recency phenomena. And what that means is that audiences tend to begin to remember the beginning of your speech and the end of your speech. That's a huge takeaway for us as speakers is, holy cow, that means the bun is more important than the burger. People tend to remember the opening story and the closing story. They don't remember the content as much. And so that's why it's so important, those first 5 minutes and those last 5 minutes, to really resonate with your audience. And so those are the types of things I work on with speakers.
So what was that called again?
That's the primacy and recency effect.
Okay, the primacy and recency effect.
Okay. So for example, I gave you a list of words, and I said, I said pillow, sheet, blanket, night, comforter, avocado, insomnia, night, sleep. So I'll ask people, okay, now try and write down all the words, as many words as you can remember. And so a lot of people will write down pillow and sleep. I'm like, yeah, you wrote those down because pillow and sleep were the first and last words that I said in the list. That's the primacy and recency effect. You know, then some people will say, I'm like, did you write the word night? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, well, I said the word night twice. You know, your brain tends to remember information that's repeated to it. You know, that's in a word, you know, so... when I'm training teachers, I say, that means as a teacher, you can't be like, oh, I'm so sorry you missed school on Tuesday. That's when I taught everybody how to add. Well, no. I mean, hopefully you're teaching adding more than just one day of the week. That it's a skill that needs to be repeated. Then I'll ask people, did you write down the word avocado? And almost every hand raises when I say avocado. I'm like, yeah, that's called the surprise effect. Your brain tends to remember information that doesn't match the pattern. Your brain's always looking for patterns, and when it sees a piece of information that doesn't fit the pattern, it stores that piece of information in an entirely different part of the brain, which ironically makes that piece stand out. And so the takeaway for us as speakers is, what can we do to be memorable? And so you'll see some people, they're memorable by the clothes they wear. They'll wear like an outrageous thing, and so you'll remember what they wore. Or sometimes you'll see speakers, and maybe they're sitting down, where they're doing something that's a surprise. It's not what you would normally think. And then the last word I'll say, people, I'm like, oh, hey, how many of you wrote down the word bed? You know, and there's a couple of people who say, I'm like, yeah, that's called that's the false memory effect. Like, I never said the word bed, but since most of the words were associated with the bed, your brain thought I actually said bed. So there's all kinds of little tricks of the trade when you're speaking, and you're trying to always be memorable. And I think the way you're memorable is by delivering meaningful messages. So there's research on this. Howard Gardner out of Harvard University talks about multiple intelligences. So some people, they hear better than they see. Some people are seeing people. Some people, when they draw, it helps them remember. Some people, if you get them up and moving, that helps them remember. Some people, if you take them outside, that helps them remember. So these are the types of things that we're trying to remember as speakers. How can we make our messages memorable?
Now, with this, like, in mind, I try to, like, go back and, like, just think of speakers who aren't really alive, but, like, you know, like, maybe speeches I've read or, like, ones that I've listened to in the past. Is there anyone who was kind of, like, an inspiration to you, or, you know, kind of, like, made this desire, like, bigger?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I watch probably at least a speaker a day, probably more like 10 to 15 speakers. I encourage everybody. To me, one of the greatest speeches I've ever seen is Steve Jobs' commencement address at Stanford. It's 15 minutes, but he's able to teach three important messages from his life, and that's not standing commencement addresses. I actually think some of the best speeches I've ever seen are commencement speeches. I would have loved to have been alive when President Lincoln was around. You know, the Gettysburg Address, you can't get much better than that. And there's an important point there, is that the Gettysburg Address is only 287 words long. So you don't have to be long to be memorable. I mean, probably the most famous speech of all time is Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. I love watching politicians that give messages of hope. That's one of the things I always admired about President Reagan. Whenever President Reagan spoke, he had this remarkable ability that whenever he spoke, I felt proud to be an American and I felt safe. And then he had just this wonderful voice, just a wonderful way of conveying messages. probably my favorite speakers, though, are always comedians, and so I can listen to comedians night and day. Unfortunately, now he it's been exposed he's not such a good person, but growing up, probably my biggest idol, besides my parents, was Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby can tell a story about nothing for 90 minutes, and I'm hanging on his every word because he's so good at putting you in the room and getting you to smell what he smells and hear what he hears. I love Bob Newhart, is another one of my favorite comedians. So I can just listen to just about any stand-up comedian are probably my favorite speakers. But I spoke at an event once where there was a 17-year-old girl who spoke before me about becoming a vegetarian, and her entire speech had nothing to do with diet. It had to do with saving the environment, and it was such an amazing speech. I was like, wow, she's 17 years old, and she just gave that, it was just a remarkable speech. So that's what I tell people is, you know, watch different people. What is it that resonates with you? I mean, I usually like funny speeches, but there's some speeches I've heard, probably one of the greatest monologues I've ever heard of was before she was famous, Whoopi Goldberg had this one-woman show off-Broadway back in the 1980s. It's actually at that show that Steven Spielberg, when he saw her, that was the reason he cast her in the film The Color Purple. But Whoopi Goldberg plays these six different characters, and the writing is incredible because she's able to get you to do those things. As I said, she gets you to laugh a lot, but she also gets you to cry, and most importantly, she gets you to think. And so I will watch any kind of speaker. Actually, you mentioned earlier my story about Winston Churchill's mother, but I listened to the speeches that Winston Churchill used to give, and his voice, the power of his voice. I mean, he would have been a remarkable, I would have loved to have hung out with Winston Churchill. I think he's definitely one of the most important people of the 20th century. Gandhi is another one of my idols. You know, Mahatma Gandhi was able to liberate India without firing a shot. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable feat. So, you know, he's a pretty good speaker.
That's true. No, with just trying to keep all of this in, like, perspective and, like, for me, you know, I was born in Sri Lanka. I came here when I was, like, maybe 2 years old. And then I always just spoke English, but, like, I've always had friends say, you know, like, when you answer the phone, you sound like you're talking British, or, like, your accent just changes. And, like have you just worked with other people or other, you know, immigrants who just, like, have this, you know, not speech impediment, but, like, it's not, you can say, in the right tone, and, like, how they developed it?
When I taught English as a second language to engineering students at the University of Southern California, my students came from all over the world, anywhere from Turkey, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Korea, and so many of them were self-conscious about their accent. And I would always tell them, I'm like, you know, we had a former governor of California who had a pretty thick accent by the name of Arnold Schwarzenegger. He did pretty well for himself. To me, accents are what give us spice and flavor. If everybody sounded like me, I think I'd have to shoot myself. I think accents are beautiful. But for those people that are self-conscious, my wife is a perfect example. She grew up in Singapore, and she spoke Hokkien. And the English that they speak there has a thick accent. And she was watching TV one day, and she was watching the interviewer interview somebody on the street. And she thought, wow, the person on the street sounds stupid, and the journalist sounds really smart. And so she actually started training herself to speak more like the newscaster. I always thought that, and you meet her today, it sounds like she's a Valley girl, that she grew up in Los Angeles. You would never know she grew up in Singapore. I read Sidney Poitier's biography, and Sidney Poitier, he literally came to America with just a shirt on his back from the Bahamas, and he was a busboy, and he was reading in the newspaper one day that there was auditions for a play for this theater in Harlem, and so he went to audition for the play, and the director said, "Don't waste my time, boy, go back to washing dishes." And Sidney Poitier thought to himself, "How does he know I wash dishes?" And so for the next 6 months, he started listening to BBC radio and speaking like the British announcers. And then he went back to the exact same director who didn't recognize him, tried out for another part, and he got the role. And so it's interesting when you say that, because especially I've worked with a lot of students and they'll listen to that BBC, listening to BBC One. BBC One, hello, welcome for the news this evening. There's only one proper way to speak English, and that is that of the language of the king or the queen. You know, well, we know that that's not true. So I tell people not to worry about their accents, but, you know, if you do want to speak in a different way, you can just mimic people. And that's, I love doing that all the time. I mimic voices all the time. Some people find it offensive. It's just something I do. My mom is from New York, and she speaks a mile a minute, and she doesn't understand that there's a past tense of the verb. She'll tell me a story. She's like, so I said to him, you know what I said to him, Danny? I said to him, hey, you can say said, drives me nuts, but that's the way she speaks. When I taught in the inner city in South Central Los Angeles, I was the only man at my school. I was the only white person at my school. I taught with predominantly elderly African-American women from the South, and my normal buddies, my group of buddies started recognizing the fact that, like, Danny, you're starting to sound like a black woman, because I'd be start talking, because I'm hanging out with black women every day, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm starting to talk like that. And we just said, you know, I told that to all of my colleagues at the school, and they just started laughing. They're like, oh yeah, you assisted with us. And I'm like, oh, well. So I think that actually does your environment definitely plays a huge role in your accent, but this is something we can work on. But I always point out to people, I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, there are so many famous speakers in history that have either had pretty thick accents or even speech impediments. I mean, I always point out to people, when I was delivering a speech in India to a school of 5,000 kids, and a six-year-old kid asked me about my childhood. And I said, my childhood wasn't easy. You know, I got made fun of, and they always put me in special education because I stuttered. And I went through a lot of different teachers, and finally I had a teacher who basically sang things to me, and I would sing back to her, and it's basically what they talk about in the movie, The King's Speech. I found when I sang, I didn't have my stutter. And eventually I lost my stutter. But the key teaching point I wanted to tell that kid is for many years people told me I was stupid and I couldn't speak very well. And isn't it interesting that many years later I traveled the entire world getting paid ridiculous amounts of money to do what? To speak. So the message for every kid is don't let anybody tell you what you can't do. It doesn't matter if you're born in Sri Lanka and you're poor. You can make yourself into a world leader. I mean, there's nothing holding you back. I get very annoyed. And now, you know, a lot of people, COVID is this horrible pandemic, but it's also teaching people how to use technology. And I'm a huge fan of the positive possibilities of technology, because right now there's some poor kid in Cambodia barefoot on a dirt floor, but if that kid has a laptop and an internet connection, that kid has the exact same access as the president of Google. The world has got a whole lot smaller. It doesn't matter if you're born in New York City or London anymore. You could be born anywhere. You can be born outside of Lagos, Nigeria, and rise to be one of the wealthiest and most prosperous people in the world. So that's my message always to kids, is don't let anybody tell you what you cannot do. If you look at the stories of great people in history, most of them started off with nothing. And that's what inspires me.
That's inspirational and motivational. But what came to my mind when you said that you were teaching English for a while, have you ever seen the show Mind Your Language?
Oh, yeah, the old show, yeah. Yeah, I love that show because it was perfect, because it had the different, and there was the Indian immigrant and the Pakistani immigrant that always fought each other. I always thought that was, that's a fantastic show.
So, yeah, it kind of, like, when you were talking about it, I just thought of that, and then, like, you know, the BBC, and, like, you know, just how they were trying to, like, teach him how to, you know, their words, and just how he's like, he was asking attendance, And then, you know, everyone was saying, you know, here, here. And then he's like, Ali, he's like, gift. And he's like, what do you mean gift? He's like, I found out that gift is also present.
That's right. That was fantastic. That's absolutely, and that was exactly right. It's difficult, too. I mean, we have expressions in America that they don't have in England. I mean, and we have expressions in different parts of America, you know. So my wife, again, she had British schooling in Singapore. And one day I was telling her, I'm like, man, our kids, they have pretty incredible vocabularies. And she's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, my oldest daughter, she just said that her toy is damaged. And my wife's like, well, what's wrong with that? And I'm like, damaged. Like American kids would say, my toy's broken, you know. And my wife's like, oh, that's how we say it. And the other thing she says, she always says things are quite. She's like, oh. She's like, it's quite hot. I'm like, oh, it's quite hot. It's quite hot. Like in America, we say it's very hot. And so it's just those little nuances. And, there was that movie years ago, Short Circuit. And again, there's the Indian immigrant. He's trying to use American expressions, but he's misusing them. So he'll say, like, for the sake of Pete, instead of for Pete's sake, you know, which cracks me up. I mean, but those are the things. The toughest thing in English is we have so many idiomatic expressions that make no sense. And you would really have to grow up here to really understand them. I mean, why do we say that? You know, we would never say you have three luggages. We'd say you have three suitcases, and together they form luggage. So it's little things like that that's going to take you a long time. That's how you'll be able to spot a person every now and then if they didn't grow up in American education system.
Yeah, and it's crazy that you said that, like, you've had, like, this back and forth with your wife. I noticed it with just my sisters, because I was the only one who just, right from preschool, just went here, and they did half their elementary school there. So they would say certain things, and they'd be like, oh, look at that squiddle. I'm like, what's a squiddle? They're like, that. I'm like, that's a squirrel.
You got to get me to Sri Lanka. It's one of the places I've always wanted to go to. I was really bummed. One summer, the Cathay Pacific had this great deal. For $900, you got an unlimited plane pass, and you could go all throughout Asia. And I didn't do it, and I really wish I had done. You had to take every flight through Hong Kong, because that was their hub, but I really wanted to do it, because one of the places I could have gone to was Colombo, which would have gotten me into Sri Lanka, and But I'll get there eventually.
you definitely should go, because I think it was last year it was voted the number one tourist destination.
Oh, wow.
And then another cool thing about it is that they have this mountain, and then on top of the mountain is like a huge 10-foot like footprint in the top of it. Now, like the people of Abrahamic faith say that it was Adam, or, you know, all the Buddhists say it's Buddha, but everyone, like, every, like, spirituality has their soul take on it. But it's a huge mountain, and it's like, you see it's like a 10-foot footprint, and you kind of wonder if, like, if we were really that tall or that big before. So, now, with, you know, just speaking and just trying to learn, and you know, I always try to, like, preach, like, this, be, like, to fall in love with learning, because when I was young, I kind of wasn't able to fall in love with learning. Rather, like, I was, like, kind of forced and be like, oh, you got to do your homework, and then I was like, I don't want to do this, like, why do I need it? But, like, what are some tools, like, say, a parent, or, you know, an older brother or older sister, or someone, like, or, you know, like a mentor can use to help, like, someone to fall in love with, like, learning or reading?
One of my favorite authors of all time is Mark Twain. I just think Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, you can't get much better than those books. He has one of my favorite quotes. He says, don't let school get in the way of your education. And my online reading engagement program, that's exactly what we do, is we train parents how to help their kids read more, read better, and love reading. And I think I said it on the last show that I appeared with you, but I want to serve your audience. If everybody goes to freereadingtraining.com, I'm going to give everybody a complimentary copy of one of my books, Read, Lead, and Succeed. It's a book which I wrote it for a school principal who didn't know how to engage his faculty. So I said, okay, I'll write you a book. And so once a week, I give you a positive concept, an inspirational quote, an inspirational story, a book recommendation on a book you should read, but you're probably too lazy because you're an adult. So I also give you a children's picture book recommendation that demonstrates the exact same concept. You know, we need to get that passion for learning, and that's developed by reading. And I also include a couple of digital trainings of trainings I do for parents to show them ways to get their kids excited about reading. I mean, this is my passion. The more excited we get kids to read, the more likely they are to read, and the more they read, the better they get. And so if you really want to become a lifelong learner, consistently passionate and curious to learn new things, then the way you do that is with reading. You know, it's to me, it's the biggest failure in the school systems right now is we don't really develop personalized curricula for each student that follows their passions. A lot of the kids that are disaffected by schools because they don't see how it applies to their lives, whereas a good teacher can spot that in every single student. Well, this student is really interested in dinosaurs, so we're going to develop a whole program around dinosaurs. And believe me, if you're a good teacher, if I had a kid that loves dinosaurs, I can teach math, I can teach social studies, I can teach science, all based on dinosaurs. I mean, just use dinosaurs as your examples for everything. The kid will be interested in that. Dinosaurs is one example. I mean, I read biographies all the time. I love stories. I love learning new things about, well, why is it this way? I just learned, one of the financial planners I was training yesterday, as a matter of fact, he told me a story, because I never realized that Cinco de Mayo, the holiday, which really isn't even celebrated in Mexico, it's more of an American holiday, but the significance of Cinco de Mayo, we were talking about financial planning, and I said, well, America needs to learn some financial planning, because we have like a $30 billion deficit. They need to learn how to balance a checkbook. And so he told me that Cinco de Mayo is basically a celebration of the Mexicans kicked out the French, and they owed the French a whole bunch of money, and that's why they celebrate Cinco de Mayo, is they didn't have to pay their debt to France. I'm like, oh, that's a great story. I didn't know that story. And that's what I'm always looking for. I'm always looking for stories of people that inspire me. The book I'm writing right now, I just wrote this book, Leadership Begins with Motivation, and this is a book, it's a collection of a whole bunch of, and actually if you have Kindle Unlimited, you can get it for free on Kindle Unlimited. It's available in paperback and Kindle on Amazon, and I wrote this book, it's just a collection of a lot of the stories I share with audiences of famous people all over the place. So what I noticed after I wrote the book, I'm like, huh, most of the examples in this book are of Americans. And back in September, I'm a visiting distinguished professor at the American University of Cairo. And I loved learning about Egyptian culture and different famous people in Egypt. I'm like, and I told them, I'm like, I need to write you a book like this, only with Egyptian examples. And so actually the book I'm writing right now, it's a book similar to this, but all of the examples are either international or women or minorities, because I think everybody needs to, you know, it's powerful to hear a story about Abraham Lincoln being born poor and rising to become one of the most beloved presidents in American history. But if you're a little kid in Sri Lanka, I think it'd be even more powerful to hear about poor kids in Sri Lanka that rose up to become titans of industry or politics or whatever. And so those are the types of stories I'm looking for right now. I actually just wrote a story about this guy in northern India, and he's a poor farmer. And basically all of his farming was getting destroyed by the drought and the flooding. And so one day he planted a tree, and then the next day he planted a tree. And so basically for the last 40 years, he's planted a tree a day, and now he's basically single-handedly created a 2,000-acre forest in northern India. He's won the highest civilian honor India has, and they named the forest after him. One guy created a forest, And it's so inspiring to me. He's known as the Forest Man of India. And I'm like, wow, it just shows you all it takes is one person. He didn't have any money. He didn't even have an education. But he knew if he plants a tree a day that he could he created a forest. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever read about in my life. One guy. And that's the type of story I think every kid needs to hear is, what are you going to do? You were put on this planet for something, and it wasn't for negative. It was for good. What are you going to do to make the world a little bit better now that you've been here? You know, and so like you, Amar, you have this show where you're exposing people to different people on your show. That's what you're doing right now. I mean, that's what I try to do in my presentations is how can I make people feel a little bit better and feel a little bit inspired? You know, there's a lot of people hurting right now. A lot of people are hurting right now. It's a horrible pandemic. There's millions of people out of work. There's millions of people that are sick. There's a lot of serious problems, and people don't need to hear the negative stories right now. I think everybody needs to be lifted up and see the possibilities rather than all the negative things that are happening.
Yeah, I agree 100%. If we can just focus on the positivity and just like you said, shed some light and inspire people and just show them a different outlook in which they want to understand, then that's the best thing to do.
So, absolutely.
Now you said you're writing another book. So in total, how many books have you published, Doctor?
I've written 16 books. This is my shelf. I always wanted to have a shelf with all of my books. But I think my favorite is this one that I just wrote. I just love it because it has so many inspirational stories. This will get you to laugh. It'll get you to cry, and it'll get you to think.
I actually wrote it down while you said it, so I'm going to check it out on Kindle after we talk.
So, check it out, and if you like it, write a review on Amazon on the book page. There's a place for people to write reviews. So,
I definitely will.
Thanks, Amar.
So, you said you like biographies and stuff, and like what kind of sort of sparked me to start this, you know, podcast or show was, you know, me writing an autobiography. And it was more not writing just notes and like from beginning to now. And, you know, just from you writing 16 books, like what is things you could tell any person who's aspiring to, you know, write a book or publish something, like, to just keep in perspective?
Yeah, so there's all kinds of people that tell me they want to write a book, and there's a difference between wanting to write a book and actually writing the book. I always tell people there's nothing fun about writing. Writing is hard. It stinks, actually, but there's nothing more gratifying than having written a book. So I always tell people, it's kind of like, I always laugh, you'll hear a lot of people, they tell you to enjoy the journey. And I say, you ever notice the people that say enjoy the journey have already succeeded? I wonder if they were enjoying the journey when they were going through it, when they were going, like, this is a lot of fun. I'm hungry, and I'm, you know, this is a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying this journey. No, you've never heard that. It's after they've succeeded. They say, oh, enjoy the journey. Writing is very tough, but sometimes you just got to push yourself to do it. I was blessed as a journalist. I learned how to really write on deadline. So I'm going to tell you a funny story. So it was between me and another speaker to speak for the school district south of Houston, Texas. And it was going to be a pretty lucrative contract. And so I asked the conference organizer, I said, well, what's the biggest challenge your teachers face in this district? And she said, well, working with English language learners. And I'm like, holy cow, I have a book about working with English language learners. If you hire me, I'll make sure every one of your teachers gets a free copy of that book. And she's like, you do that? I'm like, absolutely. And she's like, oh, great. So she signs the contract. And so I called up my friend Janice, who's my graphic designer. And I said, hey, Janice, can you design me a cover? I have to write a book tonight. And so I wrote a 125-page book that night on working with English language learners. That's the only time I ever used the book. It was to get that contract, but I got a very large speaking engagement out of it. And that's the reason I wrote the book. But I was forced to write the book. I had to. I was on deadline. And sometimes you do your best stuff when you're just...
When you give yourself a deadline. So
yeah, you need to give yourself a deadline. I mean, how many people say they want to have a podcast versus how many people actually have a podcast? You know, wanting to do something and doing it are two different things. Whether I was teaching my little ones or my older ones in my classroom, every time I end a class, as my students are exiting, they always hear me say the same thing. I'm like, remember, kids, education is valuable, but execution is priceless. Knowledge is not power. Only applied knowledge is power. Knowing what the right thing to do and doing the right thing are two totally different things. So go out and do the right thing tonight. You know, get that in people's minds. You know, there's all kinds of talkers. Right after this interview, I'm going to be talking to a guy who I've been talking to him for about 6 months about different business proposals. And I know exactly how the phone call is going to go, Amar. He's going to say, oh, I'm going to do this and this and this. I'll call you next week, because it's been the same phone conversation for 6 months. He doesn't do anything, though. My business partner, Nestor Santilla, he's incredible. He came to America from Argentina, didn't speak a word of English, became a very prosperous real estate developer, multimillionaire, and now I had the blessing of working with him. You know, when we were talking to a guy in Pakistan with his schools, Nestor the next day made the guy a website. Within a day, he created an entire website for the guy. That's why I work with Nestor, because he's not full of it. Most people, they talk, nothing ever gets done. You know, that's why I didn't like Capitol Hill. People talk, but they don't do anything. You know, I like to be around people that actually get things done. When I ran my nonprofit, I used to build school libraries in the schools, and I never asked anybody for permission. I just built the library, because if I went through the bureaucracy, and this is the problem with government, it takes years to get anything done. You know, I've written 16 books. I've worked with 5 publishing companies, so I have 5 traditional publishers, which that's great. And I tell people traditional publishers are great, but I've also self-published several of my books, and I prefer self-publishing. And the reason is because self-publishing, I can get that thing published immediately. Whereas working with a publisher, a book might take almost 2 years to get done. I mean, when I wrote this book, I wrote it, it took a couple of days to write the book, and it took a little while to design it, but this book was out within a month. You can never do that with a traditional publisher. My favorite publisher I work with, I've written 5 books with them, but the quickest turnaround time with them has been, I think, 8 months, which is really amazing for a traditional publisher. But if I published those books on my own, I could get them done a lot quicker than that. So I like things getting done. I don't like, you know, my wife, she'll let things take off. She's been talking about painting our daughter's room. And last weekend, I just painted the dang room. And she's like, wow, you painted the room. I'm like, I'm sick of hearing you talk about it. I just painted the dang room.
No, it's really I find it a little funny, but also the hard truth in what you said, because yesterday I had just spoken to someone and they were like, you know, what made you start the show and stuff? I was like, you know, I just kept hearing, you know, like, if you want to do this, you know, it's like one thing to just keep thinking about it. Just even if you don't know what to talk about, just start recording and just start. And then, but with writing, you know, like, that was like the one thing I always loved from like a young age. Like, I never really liked math. Like, history was okay, but, you know, like, just creative writing, poems, and I could get lost in writing. But then now I kind of over-criticize myself, or like kind of a perfectionist, and like, oh, this is going to be, you know, something that's going to be there forever. And then, like, I kind of feel like maybe I'm trying to put too much into it, where I should just let it be. Yeah. Definitely
remember, Amar, that perfect is the enemy of progress. You know, just get it done. It's never going to be perfect. And one of the stories I just wrote about in the new book I'm writing was about two women, Martha and Agnes. So it's Martha Graham and Agnes Mill, which probably most people don't know those names. Martha Graham is talking to Agnes Seville, and Agnes had this play that she had just produced on Broadway, but the critics just destroyed it, and she's thinking, I'm going to just close down the show. And her friend Martha says, no, you can't do that, because if you do that, this play's done, and nobody will ever see this play. There's only one you, and there's only going to ever be one you. And if you don't share what you have with the world will be denied that for history. And so Martha Graham, she is known as the mother of modern dance, and she won the Kennedy Center Honors, and I think she won the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the highest civilian honor. And her friend Agnes Seville, she took Martha's advice. She kept the play running. She changed the name of it. Agnes Seville wound up becoming one of the most successful musical producers on Broadway. And the play that she was going to close down, that she decided to stay open, she renamed it to Oklahoma. And Oklahoma became a huge hit. You know, and so just because the critics ripped it apart didn't mean the public didn't love it. I mean, there's so many examples in history of successful movies and television shows and everything where the critics are like, oh, this is horrible, this is horrible. I mean, Frank McCourt wrote Angela's Ashes. He was rejected by over 800 publishers. He finally got the book published, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Seuss, his first book was rejected by, I think, 28 publishers. It was called, And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. Well, it became the most successful book during the Great Depression, and we all know what happened to Dr. Seuss. He exploded, and the great thing about Dr. Seuss was then he decided to start publishing other authors that nobody else would publish, and so he published, there was this couple, this couple, and they wrote all these picture books with this family of bears, and nobody would publish their bear books. And Dr. Seuss said, Stan, I'll publish the books, but I think you need to rename the bears after you and Jan. And so they renamed the books the Berenstain Bears, oh. And that's the most successful books of all time. So there's always going to be critics. I don't care who you are, where you are in the world. There's always going to be people telling you you can't do it. And usually the more people tell you you can't do it, that means you're on to something. I had this quote by this guy, and it's great. He said, my first company was a miserable failure. My second company wasn't much better. The third company, we were starting to figure out how to do it right. The fourth company, we almost got it right. And the fifth company was PayPal. Well, if your fifth company is a $1 billion company, you did all right. But it's so... Here's a story I was writing yesterday. So there's this ultra marathon between Melbourne and Sydney, Australia. It's 550 miles. It's supposed to take a week. And the first time they ran the marathon was in 1983. So all of the best ultra marathon competitors around the world got to the starting line. Well, one of the people that lined up at the starting line was this scrawny 61-year-old Australian farmer by the name of Cliff Young. I mean, he showed up in his overalls. He had galoshes over his boots. And everybody looked at him like he was crazy. And so they fired the starting gun, and everybody ran. And, of course, the old farmer was in last place. And he's just running his pace and everything. Well, an interesting thing happened. That night, all the other racers, they stopped alongside the road to sleep in their tents. And Cliff Young, nobody told him he could stop. And so he just kept on running through the night. And then the next day, he just kept on running through the night. So Cliff Young, he finished the race on day 5, and not only had he won the race by over 10 hours over the guy that took second place. This 61-year-old farmer, he became this national hero because it's the true story of the tortoise feeding the hare. And he felt so badly about winning the $10,000 prize, he gave all the money to all of the other competitors, which made them all love this guy even more. And what I love about that is that there's another lesson in there, too, was he didn't do it for the money. He did it for the sheer joy of giving his best, which he did. And that's what I tell people is, you have to put out – this is exactly what I'm telling you. You have to put out what you can. So write that dang book, Amar. I'm waiting to read your book. I can't read your book if you don't publish the dang book. So write it, because you are going to be your toughest critic. You're going to have your other critics too, but you have no idea how much that book could mean to somebody out there in the world. You have to publish that book.
I think you've given me in a lot of motivation, inspired, it's a 2 liter that just got fizzed up and about to be opened. I know you probably have to attend your phone call, right, to hear about what's not going to happen.
Yep.
So, maybe the next episode that I could be blessed and have you on, I could be Dr. Danny, I finally did it, and then I have the book ready to publish.
Let's do that. We'll make that a date. Is I come on when you have that book published. Is it a deal?
It's a deal.
Good. I like it. I can't wait. That'd be great. And if you need help on figuring out how to get it published, I'm more than happy to help you on that, Amar.
Okay, I appreciate that. No, I couldn't ask you last episode, but usually I ask every guest speaker, more in the week or the day, if there's been one quote more than any other one that's been resonating with them or just keeps popping up over in their head, if you could share that and we end with that.
I don't know if there's one quote, and probably one of the most fascinating people I've ever read about is former President Teddy Roosevelt. And one of his quotes that I love, and I'm going to butcher it, but I'll paraphrase it, is he talks about the credit belongs to the person who's in the arena. And I love that. And he's basically saying there's always going to be critics out there that can criticize. It's really easy to criticize. It's a lot different to be part of the solution. And so that's what I encourage everybody in your audience is stop griping. Start doing something. I'm going to talk to this guy in 5 minutes and he's going to talk about what he's going to do. He's not going to do his thing. Anything that you actually get done is much better than anything that people say that they're going to do. Oh, I'm going to write a book. Well, write the dang book.
I like that. I hope, everyone will take this advice, and I already know certain friends were just asking, and they're going to go on the website, and then I'll make sure to leave that review on Amazon.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And just holler whenever you... I want this book published, Amar, so just tell me when you need help, and I can get you, designers and show you how to get that book published.
Okay, I appreciate all that. I'm going to make sure I get done so we could have the third episode very soon.
Excellent. Good. I look forward to it.
Thank you again, Doctor. Have a wonderful
day.
God
bless.
God bless you. Take care.
All right.
Let me see. Okay.
Yeah, I have to go to work in a little bit, so I thought it might as well just get ready now. How are you doing though today? I'm actually doing fairly well. Just woke up early and then just watched a couple of different videos, and I actually caught a couple of your videos too. It was actually the one on Winston Churchill's